in so offended as to wish to take his leave at once, without showing his face in the hall. And he'd left her there, and seen her no more. Nor did he wish ever to hear the name of Ellen Mackenzie spoken in his presence again. And with that he mounted his horse, a bit unsteady still, and rode awa', and been no friend since to any one of the clan Mackenzie.
I listened, fascinated. And where was Ellen all this time?
Old Alec laughed, with the sound of a stable door hinge creaking.
Over the hills and far away. But they didn't find it out for some time yet. We turned about and pelted home again to find Ellen still missing, and Colum standing white-faced in the courtyard, leaning on Angus Moore.
There followed more confusion still, for with all the guests the rooms of the castle were full, as were all the lofts and cubbyholes, the kitchens and closets. It seemed hopeless to tell which of all the folk in the castle might also be missing. But Colum called all of the servants and went doggedly down the lists of the invited, asking who had been seen the evening before, and where, and when. And finally he found a kitchen-maid who recalled seeing a man in a back passage just before the supper was served. She had noticed him only because he was so handsome. "Tall and sturdy," she said, "with hair like a black silky's, and eyes like a cat." She had watched him down the passage, admiring him, and seen him meet someone at the outer door, a woman dressed in black from head to toe and shrouded in a hooded cloak.
"What's a silky?" I asked.
Alec's eyes slanted toward me, crinkling at the corners.
"You call them seals in English. For quite a bit after that, even after they knew the truth of it, folk in the village would tell the tale to each other that Ellen Mackenzie was taken to the sea to live among the seals. Do you know that the silkies put aside their skins when they come ashore and walk like men? And if you find a silky's skin and hide it, he or she," he added fairly, "canna go into the sea again, but must stay with you on the land. It's thought good to take a seal wife that way, for they're very good cooks and most devoted mothers." "Still," he said judiciously, "Colum wasn't inclined to believe his sister had gone off wi' a seal, and said so. So we called the guests down one by one and asked them all who knew a man of that description. And at long last they worked it out that his name was Brian, but no one knew his clan or his surname. He'd been at the games, but there they only called him Brian Dhu."
So there the matter seemed to rest for a time, for the searchers had no idea in which direction to look. Still, even the best of hunters must stop at a cottage now and then to ask for a handful of salt or a pannikin of milk. And eventually word of the pair reached Leoch, for Ellen Mackenzie was a maid of no ordinary appearance.
"Hair like fire,"
Alec said dreamily, enjoying the warmth of the oil on his back.
"And eyes like columns, grey and fringed wi' black lashes. Very pretty, but the kind would go through ye like a bolt. A tall woman, even taller than you, and say fair it would hurt the eyes to see her. I heard tell later, as they'd met at the gathering, taken one look, and decided on the spot as there could be none other for either one of them. So they laid their plans and they stole awa' under the noses of Colum Mackenzie and 300 guests."
He laughed suddenly, remembering.
"Dougal finally found them, living in a crofter's cottage on the edge of the Fraser lands. They decided the only way to manage was to hide until Ellen was wee child, and big enough that there'd be no question whose it was. Then Colum would have to give his blessing to the marriage, like it or no. And he didn't."
Alec grinned.
"Whilst ye were on the road, did you chance to see a scar Dougal carries, running down his breast?"
"I had, a thin white line that crossed his heart and ran from shoulder to ribs."
"Did Brian do that?" I asked.
"No, Ellen," he replied, grinning at my expression. "To stop him cutting Brian's throat, which he was about to do,
I wouldn't have mentioned it to Dougal if I were you.
No, I don't suppose I will.
Luckily, the plan had worked, and Ellen was 5 months gone with child by the time that Dougal found them.
There was the great to-do about it all, and a lot of very nasty letters exchanged between Leoch and Bewley, but they settled it in the end, and Ellen and Brian took up house at Lallybroch the week before the child was born. They were married in the dooryard, he added as an afterthought, so he could carry her over the threshold for the first time as a wife, he said after, as he nearly ruptured himself lifting her.
You talk as though you knew them well, I said. Finishing my ministrations, I wiped the slippery ointment off my hands with a towel.
Oh, Abbot,
Alex said, drowsy with warmth. The lid drooped over his single eye, and the lines of his old face had relaxed from the expression of mild discomfort that normally made him look so fierce.
I ken Ellen weel, of course. Then Brian I met years later when he brought the lad to stay. We got on. A good man wi' a horse.
His voice trailed off, and the lid fell shut. I drew a blanket up over the old man's prostrate form and tiptoed away, leaving him dreaming by the fire. Leaving Alec asleep, I had gone up to our chamber, only to find Jamie in the same condition. There are a limited number of activities suitable for indoor amusement on a dark, rainy day, and assuming that I didn't wish either to rouse Jamie or to join him in oblivion, that seemed to leave reading or needlework. Given the worse and mediocre state of my abilities in the latter direction, I had decided to borrow a book from Colum's library. In accordance with the peculiar architectural principles governing the construction of Leoch, based on a general abhorrence of straight lines, the stair leading to Colum's suite had two right-angle bends in it, each marked by a small landing. An attendant usually stood on the second landing, ready to run errands or lend assistance to the laird, but he wasn't at his station today. I could hear the rumble of voices from above. Perhaps the attendant was with Colum. I paused outside the door, uncertain whether to interrupt.
I've always known you to be a fool, Dougal, but I didn't think you're quite such an idiot.
Accustomed to the company of tutors since youth, and unused to venturing out as his brother did among fighting men and common people, Colum's voice normally lacked the broad Scots that marked Dougal's speech. The cultured accent had slipped a bit now, though, and the two voices were nearly indistinguishable, both thickened by anger.
I might have expected such behaviour from you when you were in your 20s, but for God's sake, man, you're 45.
Well, it isn't a matter you'd know o'er much about now, is it?
Dougal's voice held an ugly sneer.
No.
Colum's response came in a cutting tone.
And while I've seldom found cause to thank the Lord, perhaps he's done better by me than I've thought. I've heard it said often enough that a man's brain stops working when his cock's standing. And now I think maybe I believe it.
There was a loud scrape as chair legs were pushed back against the stone flooring.
If the brothers Mackenzie have but one cock and one brain between the two of them, then I'm glad of my half of the bargain.
I decided that a third participant in this particular conversation would be decidedly unwelcome, and stepped softly back from the door, turning to go down the stair. The sound of rustling skirts from the first landing made me stop in my tracks. I didn't wish to be discovered eavesdropping outside the laird's study, and turned back toward the door. The landing here was wide, and a tapestry covered one wall almost from floor to ceiling. My feet would show, but it couldn't be helped. Lurking like a rat behind the arras, I heard the steps from below slow as they approached the door, and stop at the far side of the landing as the unseen visitor realized, as I had, the private nature of the brothers' conversation.
No, Colum was saying, calmer now. No, of course not. The woman's a witch, or next thing to it. Aye, but...
Dougal's response was cut short by his brother's impatient tones.
I've said I'll attend to it, man. Don't worry yourself over it, little brother. I'll see she's done rightly by. A note of grudging affection had crept into Colum's voice.
"I'll tell you, ma'am. I've written the Duke as he may have leave to hunt the lands above Erlich. He's keen to have a shot at the stags there. I mean to send Jimmy along with him. Maybe, as he still has some feeling for the lad."
Dougal interrupted with something in Gaelic, evidently a coarse remark, for Colum laughed and said,
"Nay, I reckon Jimmy's big enough to have a care for himself. But if the Duke's a mind to intercede for him with his Royal Majesty, it's the lad's best chance for a pardon. If you will, I'll tell his grace you'll go as well. You can aid Jimmy as you may, and you'll be out of the way while I settle matters here."
There was a muffled thump from the far side of the landing, and I risked peeping out. It was the girl, Leir, pale as the plastered wall behind her. She was holding a tray with a decanter. A pewter cup had fallen from the tray to the carpeted floor, making the sound I had heard.
"What's that?"
Colum's voice, suddenly sharp, spoke from inside the study. Leir dropped the tray on the table next to the door, almost upsetting the decanter in her haste, and turning, fled precipitately. I could hear Dougal's footsteps approaching the door, and knew I would never make it down the stairs without discovery. I barely had time to wriggle out of my hiding place and pick up the fallen cup before the door opened.
"Oh, that's you."
Dougal sounded mildly surprised.
"Is that the stuff Mrs. Fitz sent for Colum's raw throat?"
"Yes," I said glibly. "She says she hopes he'll be better presently."
"I'll do."
Moving more slowly, Colum came into view in the open door. He smiled at me.
"Thank Mrs. Fitz for me, and my thanks to you, my dear, for bringing it. Will you sit a moment while I drink it?"
The conversation I had overheard had effectually made me forget my original purpose, but I now remembered my intention of borrowing a book. Dougal excused himself, and I followed Colum slowly into his library, where he offered me the run of his shelves. Colum's colour was still high, the quarrel with his brother still fresh in his mind, but he answered my questions about the books with a good approximation of his usual poise. Only the brightness of his eyes and a certain tenseness of posture betrayed his thoughts. I found one or two herbals that looked interesting, and put them aside while I browsed a novel. Colum crossed to the bird's cage, no doubt intending to soothe himself, as per his usual custom, by watching the beautiful little self-absorbed creatures hop about amongst the branches, each a world unto itself. The sound of shouts from outside attracted my attention. From this high point, the fields behind the castle were visible all the way to the loch. A small group of horsemen was sweeping around the end of the loch, shouting with exhilaration as the rain pelted them on. As they drew nearer, I could see that they weren't men after all, but boys, mostly teenagers, but with a younger lad here and there on a pony, pressing hard to stay up with the older youths. I wondered if Hamish was with them, and quickly found the telltale spot of bright hair gleaming wildly from Coor's back in the middle of the pack. The gang came charging towards the castle, headed for one of the innumerable stone walls that separated one field from another. 1, 2, 3, 4. The older boys on their mounts popped over the wall with the careless ease born of experience. It was doubtless my imagination that made the bay seem to hang back a moment, for Coor followed the other horses with apparent eagerness. He charged the fence, set himself, braced, and leapt. He seemed to do it just as the others had, and yet something happened. Perhaps a hesitation by his rider, a too hard pulling on the reins, or a not quite firm seat. For the front hooves struck the wall just a few inches too low, and horse, rider, and all somersaulted over the wall in the most spectacular parabola of doom I had ever seen. "Oh!" Drawn by my exclamation, Colum turned his head to the window in time to see Coor land heavily on his side, the small figure of Hamish pinned beneath. Crippled as he was, Colum moved with speed. He was by my side, leaning out of the window, before the horse had even begun to struggle to his feet. The wind and rain beat in, soaking the velvet of Colum's coat. Peering anxiously over his shoulder, I saw a cluster of lads pushing and shoving each other in their eagerness to help. It seemed a long time before the crowd parted, and we saw the small, sturdy figure stumble out of the press, clutching his stomach. He shook his head to the many offers of help, and staggered purposefully to the wall, where he leaned over and vomited profusely. Then he slid down the wall and sat in the wet grass, legs sprawled, face upturned to the rain. When I saw him stick out his tongue to catch the falling drops, I laid a hand on Colum's shoulder. "He's all right," I said, "only had the wind knocked out of him." Colum closed his eyes and let his breath out, body sagging suddenly with the release of tension. I watched him with sympathy. "You care for him as though he were your own, don't you?" I asked. The grey eyes blazed suddenly into mine with a most extraordinary expression of alarm. For an instant, there was no sound in the study but the ticking of the glass clock on the shelf. Then a drop of water rolled down Colum's nose to hang glimmering from the tip. I reached involuntarily to blot it with my handkerchief, and the tension in his face broke. "Yes," he said simply. In the end, I told Jamie only about Colum's plan to send him hunting with the Duke. I was convinced by now that his feelings for Lear were only those of a chivalrous friendship. But I didn't know what he might do if he knew that his uncle had seduced the girl and got her with child. Apparently Colum didn't mean to procure the services of Geely Duncan in the emergency. I wondered if the girl would be wed to Dougal, or if Colum would find her another husband before the child began to show. In any case, if Jamie and Dougal were going to be shut up together in a hunting lodge for days on end, I thought it might be as well if the Shade of Lear were not one of the party. "He said thoughtfully, "worth a try. You get very friendly with each other, hunting all day and coming back to drink whiskey by the fire." He finished fastening my gown up the back and bent to kiss my shoulder briefly. "I'd be sorry to leave you, Sassenach, but it might be best." "Don't mind for me," I said. I hadn't realized before that his departure would necessarily leave me alone at the castle, and the thought made me more than slightly nervous. Still, I was resolved to manage, if it might help him. "Are you ready for supper?" I asked. His hand lingered on my waist, and I turned toward him. He said a moment later. "I'd be willing to go hungry." "Well, I wouldn't," I said. "You'll just have to wait." I glanced down the dinner table and across the room. By now I knew most of the faces, some intimately. And a motley crew they were, I reflected. Frank would have been fascinated by the gathering. So many different facial types. Thinking about Frank was rather like touching a sore tooth. My inclination was to shy away. But the time was coming when I would be able to delay no longer, and I forced my mind back, carefully drawing him in my mind, tracing the long, smooth arcs of his brows with my thoughts, as I had once traced them with my fingers. No matter that my fingers tingled suddenly with the memory of rougher, thicker brows, and the deep blue of the eyes beneath them. I hastily turned toward the nearest face, as an antidote to such disturbing thoughts. It happened to be Murtagh's. Well, at least he looked like neither of the men who haunted my thoughts. Short, slightly built, but sinewy as a gibbon, with long arms that reinforced the simian resemblance, he had a low brow and narrow jaw that for some reason made me think of cave dwellers and pictures of early man shown in some of Frank's texts. Not a Neanderthal, though. A Pict. That was it. There was something very durable about the small clansman that reminded me of the weathered patterned stones, ancient even now, that stood their implacable guard over crossroads and burial grounds. Amused at the idea, I looked over the other diners with an eye to spotting ethnic types. That man near the hearth, for example, John Cameron, his name was a Norman, if I'd ever seen one. Not that I had. High cheekbones and a high, narrow brow, long upper lip, and the dark skin of a Gaul. The odd fair Saxon here and there. Ah, Leah, the perfect exemplar. Pale-skinned, blue-eyed, and just the tiniest bit plump. I repressed the uncharitable observation. She carefully avoided looking at either me or Jamie, chattering animatedly with her friends at one of the lower tables. I looked in the opposite direction, toward the next table, where Dougal Mackenzie sat, apart from Colum for once. A bloody Viking, that one, with his impressive height and those broad, flat cheekbones. I could easily imagine him in command of a dragon ship, deep-sunk eyes gleaming with avarice and lust as he peered through the fog at some rocky coastal village. A large hand, wrist lightly haired with copper, reached past me to take a small loaf of oat bread from the tray. Another Norseman, Jamie. He reminded me of Mrs. Baird's legends of the race of giants who once walked Scotland and laid their long bones in the earth of the north. The conversation was general, as it usually was, small groups buzzing between mouthfuls. But my ears suddenly caught a familiar name spoken at a nearby table. Sandringham. I thought the voice was Murta's, and turned around to see. He was seated next to Ned Gowan, munching industriously.
"Sandringham! Ah! Old Wally, the ass bandit," said Ned meditatively.
"What?"
said one of the younger men-at-arms, choking on his ale.
"Our revered duke has something of a taste for boys, or so I understand," Ned explained.
"Mm-hmm,"
agreed Rupert, his mouth full. Swallowing, he added,
"Had a wee bit of a taste for young Jamie here last time he visited these parts, if I remember rightly. That were Wayne Dougal, 38, 39.
37,
Dougal answered from the next table. He narrowed his eyes at his nephew.
"You were rather a pretty lad at 16, Jamie."
Jamie nodded, chewing.
"Aye, fast too."
When the laughter had died down, Dougal began to tease Jamie.
"I didn't ken you were a favourite, Jamie, lad. There's several about the Duke as have traded a sore ass for lands and offices." "You'll notice I haven't got either one," responded Jamie with a grin, to further roars of laughter.
"What? Never even got close?"
said Rupert, chewing noisily.
"A good bit closer than I would have liked, truth be known."
"Ah! But how close would you have liked it, hey, lad?"
The shout came from further down the table, from a tall, brown-bearded man I didn't recognise, and was greeted with more laughter and ribald remarks. Jamie smiled tranquilly, and reached for another loaf, undisturbed by the teasing.
"Is that why you left the castle so sudden and went back to your father?"
asked Rupert.
"Aye. Why, you should have told me you were having trouble that way, Jamie, lad,"
said Dougal with mock concern. Jamie made a low Scottish noise in his throat.
"And if I'd told you about it, you old rogue, you would have slipped a bit of poppy juice in my ale some evening and left me in his grace's bed as a wee gift."
The table roared, and Jamie dodged as Dougal hurled an onion at him. Rupert squinted across at Jamie.
"Seems to me, lad, I saw you, soon after you left, going into the Duke's chambers near nightfall. You sure you're not holding back on us?"
Jamie grabbed another onion and threw it at him. It missed and rolled away into the rushes.
"Nay," Jamie said, laughing. "I'm a maiden still, that way at least. But if you must know all about it before you can sleep, Rupert, I'll tell you, and welcome."
Amid shouts of,
"Tell! Tell!"
he deliberately poured a mug of ale and sat back in the classic storyteller's posture. I could see Colum at the head table, head cocked forward to hear, as attentive as the ostlers and fighting men at our table.
"Well," he began, "it's true enough what Ned says. His Grace had something of an eye for me, though, being the innocent I was at 16.
Here he was interrupted by a number of cynical remarks, and raised his voice to go on.
"Being, as I say, innocent of such carryings-on, had no idea what he meant, though it seemed a bit strange to me, the way his Grace was always wanting to pat me like a wee dog, and was so interested in what I might hae in my sporran.
"Or under it,"
shouted a drunken voice. "I thought it stranger still," he went on, "when he found me washing myself at the river, and wanted to wash my back for me. When he finished my back and went on with the rest, I began to get a wee bit nervous. And when he put his hand under my kilt, I began to get the general idea. I may have been an innocent, but no a complete fool, you ken. I got out of that particular situation by diving into the water, kilt and all, and swimming across to the other side. His Grace, being not of a mind to risk his costly clothes in the mud and water. Anyway, after that I was very wary of being alone with him. He caught me once or twice in the garden or the courtyard, but there was room to get away, with no more harm than him kissing my ear. The only other bad time was when he came on me alone in the stables."
"In my stables?"
Old Alec looked aghast. He half rose to his feet and called across the room to the head table.
"Colum, you'll see that man stays out of my sheds. I'll not have him frightening my horses, Duke or no. Or troubling the boys neither," he added, as an obvious afterthought.
Jamie went on with his story, unperturbed by the interruption. Dougal's two teenaged daughters were listening raptly, mouths slightly agape.
"I was in a horse box, you ken, and there was no room to manoeuvre much. I was bending over..."
More ribald remarks.
"Bending over the manger, I say, mucking up husks from the bottom, when I hear a sound behind me. And before I can straighten up, my kilt is tossed up around my waist, and there's something hard pressed against my arse."
He waved a hand to still the tumult before going on.
"Well, I didn't care much for the thought of being buggered in a horse box, but I didn't see much way out at that point either. I was just gritting my teeth and hoping it wouldn't hurt too much when the horse..."
"It was that big black gelding, Ned. The one you got at Brocklebury, you know. The one Colum sold to Breadalbin. Anyway, the horse took an objection to the noise his Grace was making. Now, most horses like you to talk to them, and so did that one. But he had a peculiar aversion to very high voices. We couldn't take him in the yard when there were small bairns about, because he'd get nervous at their squeaks and start pawing and stamping. His Grace, you might recall, has a rather high-pitched voice, and it was a bit higher than usual on this occasion, him being a trifle excited. Well, as I say, the horse didn't care for it. Nor did I, must say. And he starts stamping and snorting and swings his body round and squashes his Grace flat against the side of the box. As soon as the Duke let go of me, I jumped into the manger and eased away round the other side of the horse, leaving his Grace to get out as best he might."
Jamie paused for breath and a sip of ale. He had the attention of the whole room by this time, faces turned toward him, gleaming in the light of the torchères. Here and there might have been discerned a frown at these revelations concerning the most puissant noble of the English crown, but the overriding reaction was an untrammelled delight in the scandal. I gathered that the Duke wasn't a particularly popular personage at Castle Leoch.
"Having been so close, as you might say, his Grace made up his mind as he'd have me, come what might. So next day he tells the Mackenzie that his body servant's fallen ill, and can he borrow me to help him wash and dress?"
Colum covered his face in mock dismay, to the amusement of the crowd. Jamie nodded to Rupert.
"That's why you saw me go to his Grace's room in the evening, under orders, you might say." "You could have told me, Jamie. I'd not have made you go,"
Colum called with a look of reproach. Jamie shrugged and grinned. I was prevented by my natural modesty, Uncle. Besides, I knew you were trying to deal with the man. I thought it might impair your negotiations a bit if you were forced to tell his grace to keep his hands off your nephew's bum.
Very thoughtful of you, Jamie, said Colum dryly. So you sacrificed yourself for my interests, did you?
Jamie raised his mug in a mock toast.
Your interests are always foremost in my mind, Uncle, he said.
And I thought that in spite of the teasing tone, there was a sharp undercurrent of truth to this, one that Conan perceived as well as I. He drained the mug and set it down.
But no, he said, wiping his mouth. In this case, I didn't feel that family duty required quite that much of me. I went to the Duke's rooms because you told me to, but that was all. And you came out again with your asshole unstretched?
Rupert sounded sceptical. Jamie grinned.
Aye, I did. You see, directly I heard about it, I went to Mrs. Fitz and told her I was in desperate need of a dose of syrup of figs. When she gave it to me, I saw where she put the bottle, and I came back quiet a bit later and drank the whole lot.
The room rocked with laughter, including Mrs. Fitz, who turned so red in the face I thought she might have a seizure. She rose ceremoniously from her place, waddled round the table, and cuffed Jamie good-naturedly on the ear.
"So that's what became of my good physic, you young wretch!"
Hands on her hips, she wagged her head, making the green ear bobbles wink like dragonflies.
"The best lot I ever made, too!" "Oh, it was most effective,"
he assured her, laughing up at the massive dame.
"I should think so. When I think what that much physic must have done to your innards, lad, I hope it was worth it to you. You can have been much good to yourself for days after."
He shook his head, still laughing.
"I wasn't, but then I wasn't much good for what his grace had in mind either. He didn't seem to mind at all when I begged leave to remove myself from his presence. But I knew I couldn't do it twice, so as soon as the cramps eased up, I got a horse from the stables and lit out. It took a long time to get home, since I had to stop every 10 minutes or so. But I made it by supper next day."
Dougal beckoned for a new jug of ale, which he passed down the board hand to hand to Jamie.
"Aye, your father sent word. He thought perhaps you'd learned enough of castle life for the present," he said,
smiling ruefully.
"I thought there was a tone to his letter I did not quite understand at the time." "Well, I hope you've laid up a new batch of figs set up, Mrs. Fitz,"
Rupert interrupted, poking her familiarly in the ribs.
"His grace is likely to be here in a day or two. Or are you counting on your new wife to guard you this time, Jamie?"
He leered at me.
"From all accounts, you may need to guard her. I hear the Duke's servant does not share his Grace's preferences, though he's every bit as active."
Jamie pushed back the bench and rose from the table, handing me out. He put an arm around my shoulders and smiled back at Rupert.
"Well then, I suppose the two of us will just have to fight it out back to back."
Rupert's eyes flew open in horrified dismay.
"Back to back?" he exclaimed. "I knew we'd forgot to tell you something before your wedding, lad. No wonder you've not got her with child yet."
Jamie's hand tightened on my shoulder, turning me toward the archway, and we made our escape, pelted by a hail of laughter and bawdy advice. In the dark hall outside, Jamie leaned against the stones, doubled over. Unable to stand, I sank to the ground at his feet and giggled helplessly.
"You didn't tell him, did you?"
Jamie gasped at last. I shook my head. "No, of course not." Still wheezing, I groped for his hand, and he hauled me upright. I collapsed against his chest.
"Let me see if I've got it right now."
He cupped my face between his hands and pressed his forehead to mine, face so close that his eyes blurred into one large blue orb, and his breath was warm on my chin. face to face. Is that it? The fizz of laughter was dying down in my blood, replaced by something else just as potent. I touched my tongue against his lips while my hands busied themselves lower down. Faces are not the essential parts, but you're learning.
Next day, I was in my surgery, listening patiently to an elderly lady from the village, some relation to the soup cook, who was rather garrulously detailing her daughter-in-law's bout with the morbid sore throat that theoretically had something to do with her current complaint of quinsy, though I couldn't at the moment see the connection. A shadow fell across the doorway, interrupting the old lady's catalogue of symptoms. I looked up, startled, to see Jamie rush in, followed by old Alec, both men looking worried and excited. Jamie unceremoniously removed the makeshift tongue depressor I was holding and pulled me to my feet, clasping both hands between his own. "What?" I began, but was interrupted by Alec, peering over Jamie's shoulder at my hands, which Jamie was displaying to him.
"Why, that's Vera well, but the arms, man, has she the arm for it?"
"Luke." Jamie grasped one of my hands and stretched my arm out straight, measuring it along one of his.
"Weel," said Alec, examining it doubtfully. "Could do. Aye, it could."
"Would you care to tell me what you think you're doing?" I inquired. But before I could finish, I was being hustled down the stairs between the two men, leaving my aged patient to gape after us in perplexity. A few moments later, I was dubiously eyeing the large, shiny, browned hindquarters of a horse, located some 6 inches from my face. The problem had been made clear on the way to the stables, Jamie explaining, and old Alec chiming in with remarks, imprecations, and interjections. Loscan, customarily a good foaler and a prize member of Colum's stable, was having trouble. This much I could see for myself. The mare lay on her side, and periodically the shining flanks heaved, and the enormous body seemed to shiver. Down on hands and knees at the rear of the horse, I could see the lips of the vagina gape slightly with each contraction, but nothing further happened. No sign of tiny hoof or delicate wet nose appeared at the opening. The foal, a late one, was evidently presenting side-on or backward. Alec thought side-on, Jamie thought backward, and they paused to argue about it for a moment until I impatiently called the meeting to order to ask what they expected me to do about it, in either case. Jamie looked at me as though I were a bit simple. "Turn the foal, of course," he said patiently. "Bring the forelegs round so it can get out." "Oh, is that all?" I looked at the horse. Loscan, whose elegant name actually meant frog, was delicately boned for a horse, but bloody big for all that. Reach inside, you mean? I glanced covertly at my hand. It probably would fit. The opening was big enough. But what then? Both men's hands were clearly too big for the job. And Roderick, the stable lad who was usually pressed into service in such delicate situations, was, of course, immobilized with a splint and sling of my devising on his right arm. He had broken his arm 2 days before. Willie, the other stable lad, had gone to fetch Roderick nonetheless, to give advice and moral encouragement. At this juncture he arrived, clad in nothing but a pair of ragged breeches, thin chest glimmering whitely in the dim stable. "It's hard work," he said dubiously, apprised of the situation and the suggestion that I substitute for him. "Tricky, again. There's a knack to it, but it takes a bit of strength as well."
"Nay worry," said Jamie confidently. "Claire's stronger by far than you poor weed. If you'll but tell her what to feel for and what to do, she'll have it round in no time."
I appreciated the vote of confidence, but was in no way so sanguine myself. Telling myself firmly that this was no worse than assisting at abdominal surgery, I retired to a stall to change my gown for breeches and a rough smock of sacking, and lathered my hand and arm up to the shoulder with greasy tallow soap.
"Well, over the top," I muttered under my breath, and slid my hand inside.
There was very little room to manoeuvre, and at first I couldn't tell what I was feeling. I closed my eyes to concentrate better, though, and groped cautiously. There were smooth expanses and bumpy bits. The smooth parts would be body and the bumps legs or head. It was legs I wanted, forelegs to be specific. Gradually I became accustomed to the feel of things and the necessity for keeping quite still when a contraction came on. The amazingly powerful muscles of the uterus clamped down on my hand and arm like a vice, grinding my own bones very painfully until the constriction eased and I could resume my groping. At last, my fumbling fingers encountered something I was sure of. "I've got my fingers in its nose," I cried triumphantly. "I found the head."
"Good, lass, good. Dinna let go."
Alec crouched anxiously alongside, patting the mare reassuringly as another contraction set in. I gritted my teeth and leaned my forehead against the shining rump as my wrist was crushed by the force. It eased, though, and I kept my grip. Feeling cautiously upward, I found the curve of eye socket and brow and the small ridge of the folded ear. Waiting through one more contraction, I followed the curve of the neck down to the shoulder. "It's got its head turned back on its shoulder," I reported. "The head's pointing the right way, at least."
"Good."
Jamie, at the horse's head, ran his hand soothingly down the sweating chestnut neck.
"Likely the legs will be folded under the chest. See, can you get a hand on one knee?"
So it went on, feeling, fumbling, up to my shoulder in the warm darkness of the horse, feeling the awful force of the birth pangs and their grateful easing, struggling blindly to reach my goal. I felt rather as though I were giving birth myself, and bloody hard work it was, too. At last I had my hand on a hoof. I could feel the rounded surface and the sharp edge of the yet unused curve. Following the anxious, often contradictory instructions of my guides as best I could, I alternately pulled and pushed, easing the unwieldy mass of the foal around, bringing one foot forward, pushing another back, sweating and groaning along with the mare. And then suddenly everything worked. A contraction eased, and all at once, everything slid smoothly into place. I waited, not moving, for the next contraction. It came, and a small, wet nose popped suddenly out, pushing my hand out with it. The tiny nostrils flared briefly, as though interested in this new sensation. Then the nose vanished.
"Next one will do it!"
Alec was almost dancing in ecstasy, his arthritic form capering up and down in the hay.
"Come on, Luascan. Come on, my sweet wee froggy."
As though in answer, there was a convulsive grunt from the mare. Her hindquarters flexed sharply, and the foal slid smoothly onto the clean hay in a slither of knobby legs and big ears. I sat back on the hay, grinning idiotically. I was covered with soap and slime and blood, exhausted and aching, and smelt strongly of the less pleasant aspects of horse. I was euphoric. I sat watching as Willie and the one-handed Roderick tended the new arrival, wiping him down with wisps of straw, and cheered with the rest when Luascan turned and licked him, butting him gently and nosing him to stand at last on his huge wobbly feet.
"A damn good job, lassie! Damn good!"
Alec was exuberant, pumping my unslimed hand in congratulation. Suddenly, realizing that I was swaying on my perch, and much less than presentable, he turned and barked at one of the lads to bring some water. Then he circled behind me and set his horny old hands on my shoulders. With an amazingly deft and gentle touch, he pressed and stroked, easing the strain in my shoulders, relaxing the knots in my neck.
"There, lassie," he said at last. "Hard work, no?"
He smiled down at me, then beamed adoringly at the new colt.
"Bonny laddie," he crooned. "Who's a sweet lad, then?"
Jamie helped me to clean up and change. My fingers were too stiff to manage the buttons of my bodice, and I knew my entire arm would be blue with bruising by morning. But I felt thoroughly peaceful and contented. The rain seemed to have lasted forever, so that when a day finally dawned bright and fair, I squinted in the daylight like a newly emerged mole.
"Your skin is so fine I can see the blood moving beneath it," Jamie said,
tracing the path of a sunbeam across my bare stomach.
"I could follow the veins from your hand to your heart."
He drew his finger gently up my wrist to the bend of the elbow, up the inner side of my upper arm, and across the slope below my collarbone. "That's the subclavian vein," I remarked, looking down my nose at the path of his tracking finger.
"Is it? Oh, aye, because it's below your clavicle. Tell me some more."
The finger moved slowly downward.
"I like to hear the Latin names for things. I never dreamed it would be so pleasant to make love to a physician."
"That," I said primly, "is an areola. And you know it, because I told you last week."
"So you did,"
he murmured.
"And there's another one. Fancy that."
The bright head dipped to let his tongue replace the finger, then travelled lower.
"Umbilicus," I said, with a short gasp.
"Hmm,"
he said, muffled lips stretching in a smile against my transparent skin.
"And what's this, then?"
"You tell me,"
I said, clutching his head. But he was incapable of speech. Later, I lounged in my surgery chair, basking dreamily in memories of awaking in a bed of sunbeams, sheets tumbled in blinding shoals of white like the sands of a beach. One hand rested on my breast, and I toyed idly with the nipple, enjoying the feel of it rising against my palm beneath the thin calico of my bodice.
"Enjoying yourself?"
A sarcastic voice from the door brought me upright so quickly that I bumped my head on a shelf.
"Oh," I said, rather grumpily. "Gilly."
"Who else?"
"What are you doing here?"
She glided into the surgery, moving as though on wheels. I knew she had feet. I'd seen them. What I couldn't figure out was where she put them when she walked.
"I came to bring Mrs. Fitz some saffron from Spain. She was wanting it against the Duke's coming."
"More spices," I said, beginning to recover my good humour. "If the man eats half the things she's fixing for him, they'll need to roll him home."
"They could do that now. He's a wee round ball of a fellow, I've heard."
Dismissing the Duke and his physique, she asked whether I'd like to join her for an expedition to the nearby foothills. "I'm needing a bit of moss," she explained. She waved her long, boneless hands gracefully to and fro.
"Makes a wonderful lotion for the hands, boiled in milk with a bit of sheep's wool."
I cast a look up at my slit window where the dust motes were going mad in the golden light. A faint scent of ripe fruit and fresh-cut hay floated on the breeze.
"Why not?"
Waiting as I gathered my baskets and bottles together, Gilly strolled about my surgery, picking things up and putting them down at random. She stopped at a small table and picked up the object that lay there, frowning.
"What's this?"
I stopped what I was doing and came to stand beside her. She was holding a small bundle of dried plants tied with three twisted threads, black, white, and red.
"Jamie says it's an ilwish."
"He's right. Where did ye come to get it?"
I told her about the finding of the small bundle in my bed. "I went and found it under the window next day, where Jamie threw it. I meant to bring it round to your house and ask if you knew anything about it, but I forgot." She stood tapping a fingernail thoughtfully against her front teeth, shaking her head.
"No, I canna say that I do. But there might be a way of finding out who left it for you."
"Really?"
"Aye. Come to my house in the morning tomorrow, and I'll tell you then."
Refusing to say more, she whirled about in a swirl of green cloak, leaving me to follow as I would. She led me well up into the foothills, galloping when there was road enough to do so, walking when there wasn't. An hour's ride from the village, she stopped near a small brook overhung by willows. We forded the brook and wandered up into the foothills, gathering such late summer plants as still lingered, together with the ripening berries of early autumn and the thick yellow shelf fungus that sprouted from the trunks of trees in the small shady glens. Gili's figure disappeared into the bracken above me as I paused to scrape a bit of aspen bark into my basket. The globules of dried sap on the papery bark looked like frozen drops of blood, the deep crimson refulgent with trapped sunlight. A sound startled me out of my reverie, and I looked up the hill in the direction it seemed to come from. I heard the sound again, a high-pitched, mewling cry. It seemed to come from above, from a rocky notch near the crest of the hill. I set my basket down and began to climb. "Gili!" I shouted. "Come up here! Someone's left a baby!" The sound of scrabbling and muttered imprecations preceded her up the hill as she fought her way through the entangling bushes on the slope. Her fair face was flushed and cross, and she had twigs in her hair. "What in God's name?" she began, and then darted forward. "Christ's blood, put it down!" She hastily snatched the baby from my arms, then laid it back where I had found it, in a small deep depression in the rock. The smooth, ball-shaped hollow was less than a yard across. At one side of the hollow was a shallow wooden bowl, half full of fresh milk, and at the baby's feet was a small bouquet of wildflowers tied with a bit of red twine. "But it's sick," I protested, stooping toward the child again. "Who would leave a sick child up here by itself?" The baby was plainly very ill. The small pinched face was greenish, with dark hollows under the eyes, and the little fists waved weakly under the blanket. The child had hung slack in my arms when I picked it up. I wondered that it had had the strength to cry. "It's parents," Gili said briefly, restraining me with a hand on my arm. "Leave it. Let's get out of here."
"It's parents," I said indignantly. "But..."
"It's a changeling," she said impatiently. "Leave it and come. Now." Dragging me with her, she dodged back into the undergrowth. Protesting, I followed her down the slope until we arrived breathless and red-faced at the bottom, where I forced her to stop.
"What is this?" I demanded.
"We can't just abandon a sick child out in the open like that."
"What do you mean, it's a changeling?"
"A changeling," she said impatiently. "Surely you know what a changeling is." "When the fairies steal a human child away, they leave one of their own in its place. You know it's a changeling because it cries and fusses all the time and doesn't thrive or grow."
"Of course I know what it is," I said. "But you don't believe that nonsense, do you?"
She shot me a sudden strange look, full of wary suspicion. Then the lines of her face relaxed into their normal expression of half-amused cynicism.
"No, I don't," she admitted, "but the folk here do."
She glanced nervously up the slope, but no further sound came from the rocky notch. "The family will be somewhere near about. Let's go." Reluctantly, I allowed her to tow me away in the direction of the village.
"Why did they put it up there?" I asked, sitting on a rock to remove my stockings before wading across a small stream. "Do they hope the wee folk will come and cure it?"
I was still bothered about the child. It seemed desperately ill. I didn't know what was wrong with it, but perhaps I could help.
"Maybe I could leave Gili in the village, then come back for the child. It would have to be soon, though."
I glanced up at the eastern sky, where soft grey rain clouds were swiftly darkening into purple dusk. A pink glow still showed to the west, but there could be no more than half an hour's light left.
Gili looped the twisted, withy handle of her basket over her neck, picked up her skirt, and stepped into the stream, shivering at the cold water.
"No," she said. "Or rather, yes.
That's one of the fairies' hills, and it's dangerous to sleep there. If you leave a changeling out overnight in such a place, the folk will come and take it back, and leave the human child they've stolen its place. But they won't, because it isn't a changeling, I said, sucking in my breath at the touch of the melted snow water. It's only a sick child. It might very well not survive a night in the open.
It won't, she said briefly. It will be dead by morning, and I hope to God no one saw us near it.
I stopped abruptly in the midst of putting on my shoes.
Dead?
Gilly, I'm going back for it. I can't leave it there. I turned and started back across the stream. She caught me from behind and pushed me flat on my face into the shallow water. Floundering and gasping, I managed to rise to my knees, sloshing water in all directions. Gilly stood calf-deep in the stream, skirts soaked, glaring down at me. "You bloody pig-headed English ass!" she shouted at me. "There's nothing you can do! Do you hear me? Nothing! That child's as good as dead. I'll not stand here and let you risk your own life and mine for some crack-brained notion of yours!" Snorting and grumbling under her breath, she reached down and got me under the arms with both hands, lugging me to my feet. "Claire," she said urgently, shaking me by the arms, "listen to me. If you go near that child and it dies, and it will, believe me, I've seen them like that, then the family will blame you for it. Do you not see the danger of it? Don't you know what they say about you in the village?" I stood shivering in the cold breeze of sunset, torn between her obvious panic for my safety and the thought of a helpless child slowly dying alone in the dark, with wildflowers at its feet. "No," I said, shaking the wet hair out of my face. "Gilly, no, I can't. I'll be careful, I promise, but I have to go." I pulled myself out of her grasp and turned toward the far bank, stumbling and splashing in the uncertain shadows of the stream bed. There was a muffled cry of exasperation from behind me, then a frenzied splashing in the opposite direction. Well, at least she wouldn't hamper me further. It was growing dark fast, and I pushed through the bushes and weeds as quickly as I could. I wasn't sure that I could find the right hill if it grew dark before I reached it. There were several nearby, all about the same height. And fairies or not, the thought of wandering about alone out here in the dark wasn't one I cared for. The question of how I was going to make it back to the castle with a sick baby was something I would deal with when the time came. I found the hill, finally, by spotting the stand of young larches I remembered at the base. It was nearly full dark by this time, a moonless night, and I stumbled and fell frequently. The larches stood huddled together, talking quietly in the evening breeze with clicks and creaks and rustling sighs. "Bloody place is haunted," I thought, listening to the leafy conversation overhead as I threaded my way through the slender trunks. "I wouldn't be surprised to meet a ghost behind the next tree." I was surprised, though. Actually, I was scared out of my wits when the shadowy figure slid out and grabbed me. I let out a piercing shriek and struck at it. "Jesus Christ," I said. "What are you doing here?" I crumpled for a moment against Jamie's chest, relieved to see him in spite of the fright he had given me. He took me by the arm and turned to lead me out of the wood.
"Came for you," he said, low-voiced. "I was coming to meet you because night was coming on. I met Gilles Duncan near St. John's Brook, and she told me where you were."
"But the baby," I began, turning back toward the hill.
"The child's dead," he said briefly, tugging me back. "I went up there first to see."
I followed him then without demur, distressed over the child's death, but relieved that I would not, after all, have to face the climb to the fairy's crest or the long journey back alone. Oppressed by the dark and the whispering trees, I didn't speak until we had crossed the brook again. Still damp from the previous immersion, I didn't bother removing my stockings, but sloshed across regardless. Jamie, still dry, stayed that way by leaping from the bank to a central boulder that stood above the current, then vaulted to my bank like a broad